Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling authentic. And I know you're kind of surprised, aren't you, that I said that? I've been thinking a lot about masks and, you know, that famous Oscar Wilde quote, which I know everyone mentions all the time. It's almost kind of so literal and, everywhere. But the quote is, man is least himself when he talks in his own person. Give him a mask and he will tell you the truth. And I've been thinking a lot about the last few years. We've kind of, you know, created this platform with Talk Art, and I think a lot of it has been us realizing that we are comfortable with ourselves and sort of using our platform to help other people, and also finding our own voice and our own opinions and being kind of strong enough to sort of say what you think in the world. And there's an artist who we were supposed to meet before the original lockdown. So I think it was like early 2020 we were originally going to meet, because he'd had a really cool show on in central London at Stephen Friedman Gallery that had an array of masks in different forms, ceramic masks. And I loved that show so much.
Same.
And I'm so thrilled that we're finally getting to meet him and chat to him. But he also works across performance and installation in a way, because I've always felt like his exhibitions are really well installed, and he's made these kind of totemic sculptures of late, which also, as an audience member, as a viewer, you kind of go through them, and it's a real experience. And I love the way that he works with space. And we've hung out a few times in Margate and in London, and I originally met him through a really great collector in London called Karen Smith, who's based in Hampstead. And Karen's a really, really great kind of philanthropist, almost. Like, she really supports emerging talent. Is super encouraging person, also to myself as a gallerist. So shout out to Karen. But we would like to welcome to Talk Art Jonathan Baldock. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. It's exciting.
Yeah, so exciting.
Very welcome. Where are you in the world, Jonathan?
Where am I at the moment? I'm at home, actually, today. I've just done my washing. Oh. A glamorous Sunday. So living it up. And that's it, really.
You're based in London.
I'm based in London, exactly. Yeah.
Behind you here, which the audience can't see, it feels like you live in a studio. Do you have a live worker situation?
Are you saying it's a mess? It is.
Well, I'm saying there's like sculptures on shelves, and it looks like a workspace.
It's because it's because I'm actually in the process of moving. So what you're seeing is like lots of empty shelves and boxes and, you know, things. So it's a bit, it's a place that's in the midst of a move. I was thinking about it, actually. I've moved, I'm 41 and I've moved 30 times in my life.
Wow.
So this is, I know, right? It's quite a lot.
Yes.
So I'm packing up and moving again. Hence, you know, life on the road.
Where are you off to this time?
I don't know at the minute. I'm just
come to Margate.
Which is a bit, I know. It's because I've got a show coming up in Stockholm that I'm going to install in a week. And so I thought I've got some options, basically. I've got some fires in the iron about where I might move to, and at the minute I'm not quite sure which one I'm gonna end up at, but yeah, so that's it. So state of...
Are you quite a minimalist to have moved 30 times? I mean, every time I've moved, I've wanted to kill myself because it's too much.
Yeah, I should be, given I've just said that I moved quite a lot, but actually I just collect a lot of stuff and things, and just, and like, I've got so many books. I think they're, yes, because they're the one thing that I've always allowed myself, even when I don't have money to buy, because I thought that's sort of guilt-free. But the thing is, when you're moving big boxes of books, they're the worst to carry, aren't they?
The worst.
Oh, my God.
Because they're just like solid lumps of... well, would, you know, so.
Exactly. But your studio, you keep in the same studio, and do you have a studio you travel to?
Yes. So my studio is in Bromley by Bow.
Right.
And again, there's lots of boxes there, and it's quite, you know, I've got a lot of stuff and things in boxes piled up, and yeah.
Can you sleep in the studio? Can you sleep in the studio though? If push comes to shove,
yes, I can. That's my backup, Russell. You know, if it all goes to shit, I can go and live in the studio for a few days. But let's hope that doesn't happen. It's happened before, but yeah.
Has it? What, the last 30 times you've moved? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So it's, you're a bit from, basic, though,
you know,
right.
Washing in a bucket. It's not the dream, you know. It's not.
No. You just said that you're a collector, though. You're a collector of other things as well as books.
Yeah, I collect a lot of. I've always collected a lot. As a kid, I used to collect, well, the basic stuff: stamps, badges, coins, miniature toy car. You know, like pretty much anything that was pretty cheap.
Dinkies.
That you could collect.
Dinky cars.
Dinky, exactly. I would collect it. I've always found a preciousness of objects and things, and keeping them in order has always been appealing to me. Yeah,
that's quite interesting. If you think about that show that we saw in 2019 in London, in central London, with Stephen Friedman, like even that show, there's a kind of like rhythm and order. And even though each mask that you had hanging on the wall were completely unique and different, there was a kind of unity between them all, almost like a collection. I hadn't really thought of it like that before.
No, do you know? I was thinking. I mean, I said this before. I used to be a bit of a bird watcher, and even the way that I used to watch birds was that I used to do a little cross in the corner of my Reader's Digest Birds of the British Isles, and every time I'd seen one, so it was almost like collecting viewings of these birds. You know? So you know, maybe those masks are like sort of a collection of an emotions, expressions. You know, that I've sort of. I've built up, and I've got quite a steady collection of them now. So,
I think we're kindred spirits, Jonathan. I was reading Armistead Maupin's book this morning. I was flicking through it, and he said something that stuck with me, that when he was a kid, he used to go antiquing. So he's American, and his mum used to take him antiquing. And he says at a revealingly early age, he went antiquing. And there's this affinity or a synergy between antiquing as a young boy and being gay. And it's something about, I don't know what it is. Do you know what that would be? But it absolutely struck a chord with me when I read that line.
So interesting.
I can believe it. I mean, I think for me, I guess the parallel would be jumble sales. I used to go to jumble sales with my mum.
Same. Oh my God, and, we're the same person.
In fact, actually one of my favourite toys, and I don't even remember this, but I was in a pram and my sister was pushing me. And I just had my hand up for this like knitted rabbit that I just wouldn't leave alone. Ended up being my favorite. It's called Peggy Higgins. Was my favorite toy. So even from a sort of, before I can even remember, I loved. It's that sort of potential to sort of find some treasure or something.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
There might be something to discover, you know, which is really exciting. And
I was trying to work out, it's this, because we're kids, but we were feverishly trying to understand everything or learn things or know about things, that we could go into these jumble sales as the innocent, not as like a dealer, but we sort of knew what we're looking for. We trained our eyes for the antique, the bit of treasure in the rough, but we could go in and get it for like 10p. Whereas if we did it now at this age, they'd be like, right, well, they put a few zeros in the end of that. They'd be like, you know what you're doing. But as a kid, it was like, I felt like they don't even know that I know what this is.
Exactly. And also you have the advantage of height, so you can just sort of slip in there. Do you know what I mean? Get to the front of the queue.
the box to rummage through. Yeah.
Exactly. My mum had some good elbows and she's quite small as well, so she was always... But now I'm lost at the back. It's, you know... and like you say, it's like... I think you get charged more now. It's like...
Exactly. They can spot you. You're an adult and they go, no, I'm not giving you this 10p. I don't feel sorry for you. Even your charm isn't working right now. Pay me the full price. Yes, exactly. So you were born in Kent. I guess this is where you did most of your jumble sales and boot sales and antiquing. In 1980, you were saying you're 41. And you were, as a young kid, you were doing lots of crafty things, discovering like how to, as you've said, a beautiful thing, bringing together the head and the hand, which is, I've read somewhere, which is a beautiful line of yours, which I love to quote. But you were working that out growing up. You could have been anything really, because you feel like you're the king of craft. Everything seems to be something you've tried.
I mean, I think I sort of pull from what I know. And, you know, as a kid, I learned to sort of knit and crochet from a really young age because my nan taught me how to do those things. And so when my mum, during the holidays, my mum was off to work, she would leave me with my nan and we'd do these things together. And so, and they were things that I really, really loved to do as well. So, you know, I, obviously pretty cool kid, you know, as you can imagine, and loved to crochet, knit. So and do all of these things. And I don't know, I think there was a sort of a period, you know, as you sort of become a teenager and you sort of, you know, you feel like maybe these are things that maybe you shouldn't be doing, or I don't know, you know, they're just,
it's such a shame,
like,
that
they're not cool. I know.
And yeah, like it's not cool, so you want to repress
it. You feel ashamed. You feel ashamed that you go that, I'm not into football, but there's not, I can't admit to being into collecting things. I can't admit to being passionate or enthusiastic about things that are off the beaten track.
Totally. You know, that it becomes, you know, you become aware of it just not being acceptable, you know, or okay. So I sort of pushed those things to the side for a while. And it wasn't until I went to art school, actually, and I did painting. And
this is in Winchester.
At Winchester School of Art, exactly. And I started picking up or having desire to make things. And I think I was a bit intimidated by the sculpture department. So I sort of tapped into what I knew to make things, which was obviously, you know, very textile orientated. And so thinking about how I could make sculptures and objects and installations with fabrics and things that are very cheap, I guess, as well, you know, and just led me onto sort of the path that I guess that I'm at now, which is, you know, constantly, I mean, it's such a sort of, I mean, there's so many endless crafts, I guess, mediums to try, you know. I mean, I recently started spinning my own yarn, and that was, a whole new thing. You know, I think there's many that I think would take, you know, a lifetime to learn, but there's also lots that you can really pick up yourself, and that sort of autonomy of doing, of learning how to do something yourself is very powerful, I think, actually.
Something that strikes me with you is that everything you're talking about, it sounds quite like, you know, you're using your hands. It's quite like in relation to the size of your body, almost like, you know, you think of the masks you've made, all of those kind of series of works, even the heads you did earlier on that I think I first saw weirdly at the Saatchi Gallery or somewhere like that. But actually, you've always had this almost like ambition to do something greater from that. So you might have like many smaller parts that create a much larger installation. And if you go back even to like 2006, that installation that was called Fat Face Tells Porkies, I love that work. And that kind of giant face, and you're talking about materials that were very easy to come by, and I feel like there's almost like twigs or you know, like bits of trees within that. And can you talk a bit about that kind of ambition to respond to space and to think about things on a larger scale outside of your actual physical scale?
Well, I think like the body is always central to the work that I make, and I think that's the thing about craft materials, you know, they are so directly related to the body. So I think it was just sort of a natural progression that I would start thinking about scale and how, I mean, I'm always thinking about the viewer as well in the work, you know, how they move around the space, how you can essentially choreograph them in a gallery space, how they can sort of enter a world that I've created, and maybe I can divert their eye to look beyond the sort of, you know, just the straightforward, and asking them to walk under the work or, you know, over a work. You know, I think these are things that I really enjoy doing. And, you know, thinking about, like, for instance, your Fat Face Tells Porkies, the work that you mentioned, I think, you know, that was a work that I wanted to make something really monstrous. I think the thing is with craft materials, they often have quite cozy connotations.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I I'm quite interested in just trying to sort of pulling away from that kind of those perceptions of the medium, and just that, you know, making it something big and monstrous. Quite often it will have to be quite done in quite sort of modular ways, like you've just said, because of the limitations with which I've had to make them. For instance, in Camden Art Centre, when I made the columns, you know, they were sort of you know, the size of the kiln, essentially. So, right. You know, how do I make them big? I sort of stack them up or join them together. And that's how I've kind of gone about making something sort of monumental out of materials that are quite, I guess, essentially quite humble.
Right. Yeah. I also remember the work back then being quite shocking. Like, I remember seeing those heads, and the aesthetic of it was almost like, kind of not it wasn't aggressive, but there's definitely like a kind of
a
macabre
grotesque.
Yeah, grotesque, dark humor, a bit twisted, but also a kind of ugliness at the same time as being quite classically beautiful,
humorous,
or something.
Yeah.
And humorous. Yeah, it's kind of a weird combination of things.
Yeah, I mean okay, those, so are you talking about the salt dough heads that were shown at the start sheet? So
exactly.
I started working at in salt dough because I didn't have access to clay, and they were, like you say, they were essentially sort of classic busts. They were modelled on a male head, and then they were sort of they're very ornamental and had all this decoration all over them. And the things that maybe that should have been on the outside, like the hair and things, were spewing out of the mouth, and so it had this sort of like external things coming from within. But I guess I really wanted to, you know, again, it's using a material which is something, you know, like as simple as flour, salt and water, and then sort of making it refer to the busts of classical antiquity, you know. Also, they were colourful, because I think at that time, you know, it's more common knowledge now, but, you know, there was this kind of looking at Roman and classical Greek sculpture and seeing that it would have originally been painted in colour and probably looked much closer to sort of Madame Tussauds kind of,
right.
You know, it wasn't this sort of white
alabaster porcelain
marble,
sort of thing. Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
That we've sort of grown to accept in sort of, certainly in the Western tradition, it was something much more decorative and brightly coloured than that. And so I guess that sort of bringing that, what I mean, could be looked at sort of quite kitsch elements to the work was an important thing for me, I think.
Didn't you let these all dry in front of a radiator as well, because they were too big for the oven at this stage? This was all like a stage in your career when money was obviously something you had to consider when creating your work.
Yeah, I did. And I'm also, I mean, because if you notice, the heads are just the right size to fit in the oven. But I sort of came up with a way to do this where you had to sort of...
Would it be staring out at you like a nursery? Like Hansel and Gretel, yeah. Oh, my God.
These two little glass eyes. They also had hair in them, so it couldn't be, you know, it had to be such a slow... So my housemates must have loved me, because they used to leave the oven on, you know, for 12 hours at a time, slowly drying out these salt dough heads, and then, like you say, leaving them by the radiator. You know, it was just a way. I didn't have a studio at the time as well, so it was about, I just graduated from the RCA, and it was about making work when you didn't have facilities and money, I guess. So you know, so I literally used the cheapest thing possible, which was, you know, making salt dough in the kitchen.
It's like Play-Doh, wasn't it?
Like Play-Doh, exactly.
And the colours came from like food colouring that you added at the kneading stage of the sculpture.
Exactly, yeah. So they sort of have an almost, I guess, sort of cake, sort
cakey.
Of icing, yeah, cakey look about them, yeah.
Yeah. So do you know when you start these sculptures how they're going to end up? And the same for you, talking about your installations then, about how an audience navigates its way through your installations. Are these things that you know when you begin a body of work, or are these things that you kind of improvise and let them tell you what they are?
I think it's a bit of both. So, you know, for instance, with the salt dough heads or the ceramic masks, I think I can be much more intuitive in the way that I make them, because in a way the sort of the format is already set. So I know it's going to have a certain size, and then within those limitations, I can be quite playful. But I think with the installations, then I am much more, you know, there's a lot more thought. It's just a very different way of working, you know. So mm-hmm. I think I address them a little bit more like they are plays or something like that, you know. There's yes. a script and, you know, yes. And then there's a stage and then there's a certain set characters that I want to include. Mm. And then it's up to their individual interpretation of the role, you know, and that's when I guess they can sort of be a bit more playful, you know.
Mm. Well, you're the writer director of your plays because they are incredibly theatrical and there's a lot of puppetry in there. And like, I imagine animatronic at some stage is going to be something that you will consider. I don't know if you have already, but that feels like something that is totally innate to the work.
Yeah, I would love to. There's lots of things that I'm still, you know, eager to do. I'd like to do film as well, you know, but that hasn't, you know, there's lots of things on my sort of bucket list of avenues I want to try, you know, and I think.
Yeah, I think you should do a ballet or an opera. You should be doing the I'd costumes for that. Yeah,
I would love to. I'm just waiting for somebody to ask me to do.
Yeah.
Any curators listening?
Even through all this, there's like, you know, they feel very British. It feels very English, what these creations you have. And they are theatrical, but they feel kind of Shakespearean. As we said, there's like opera and ballet, but they also feel like you're splicing art history when it comes to like Victorian times and Tudor times. Then they feel Dickensian on one turn. They're really kind of highly camp, but they're like part of a carnival.
Right. No, I'll take that. That's I'll take that. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a big lover of all. I love art, you know, and I, you know, I'm a bit of a saddo, so I'm an artist, but then in my spare time I'll go to art galleries or, you know, museums, and so I'm constantly soaking up imagery and references that will then find themselves in the work. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've always done. And, you know, I don't come from an artistic background at all. You know, nobody in my family is an artist or really anything that's sort of, you know, design or any, it comes from anything. But it's something that I really love, you know, and I guess it's a bit of an obsession. So,
yeah, I think that comes from like boot sales and jumble sales and antiquing and having them sort of references all through your childhood, just like these images of like a chamber pot or these images of like, you know, Victoriana or Edwardian furniture and stuff. These things all kind of play into your decision making when you're telling your stories.
It's the search for the beautiful thing, isn't it? You know?
Exactly. So let's talk about Camden Art Centre, the show that you had recently that you were talking about, which was called Face Crime. And these were these stacked columns, which you said you were limited because of the size of the kiln. But these were something that triggered you to create them from a recent Syrian discovery of some clay tablets from 2500 BC that you saw in the news. And that then triggered a whole new body of work.
Yeah, so it's actually the Assyrian Empire, which is an ancient Mesopotamian kingdom. And Assyria would now be modern day Iraq, as well as parts of Iran, Kuwait, Syria and Turkey. Yeah, so I was in the Mesopotamian Gallery in the British Museum looking at these clay tablets. And I was really fascinated, not just with them as physical objects, but also the fact that this is like the oldest form of written language and existed for, I think, over 3,000 years, so it had quite a stint. And it's a language that's completely extinct now and was really only discovered in the late 19th century, I think, with this discovery of these clay tablets in Iraq. I was fascinated with this language primarily because it was discovered through clay. So clay as this medium to communicate felt like a good way to start thinking about my show at Camden Arts Centre. And so I mirrored that with the fastest growing language today, which is emojis. Emojis are often used to sort of to fill an emotional cue in a type language. And for me, I often think about my work as being about or wanting to explore the ways in which we communicate as human beings. So, yeah, I was looking at this ancient cuneiform language, mirroring that with the fastest growing language today. And then also within the work, I looked at ways in which humans communicate non-verbally. So things like sighs, grunts, whistles, laughters. And I created an audio work piece within the ceramic columns, so that each of the columns appeared like they were communicating with each other and having a sort of a conversation non-verbally with these sounds, and as if to sort of evoke emotions. So they had a sort of a character that was described through the sort of emotional signals that they were giving out. Also included whistles, because whistles are they have a sort of history of being a language in and amongst themselves, because there are certain communities in sort of mountainous regions that use whistles to communicate. Some are very complex, and you can even ask for loaves of bread and things. I mean, it's kind of amazing. So that was my thinking about that. I should also say as well that one of the things that I found out about these clay tablets that were discovered were they often fitted in the palm of the hand as well. And I found that really fascinating, because if you're sort of mirroring that with a sort of the modern day equivalent would be a mobile phone. So there was this nice sort of connection with, one of the most ancient languages that is no longer in existence, and then the fastest growing one that exists in the non-physical, wow, in the digital today.
So this was in 2019, and it was at Camden. It moved on to, it toured to the tramway in Glasgow. So it went up there, which is amazing. But can we talk about the importance of Camden Arts Centre, what that is for people who don't know, and the importance of the fellowship, because you did the fellowship and the residency. Is that the same thing, or are they two separate things? And what is that? What does that give you as an artist?
So it was a fellowship residency. It came under the same umbrella. I think for me, it was incredibly important.
What is it? What actually is it that you get the residency?
What I got was 6 months. Free access into their ceramic studio. So if anybody knows Camden Arts Centre, it's quite unique in that it has a ceramic studio just to the right hand side of the gallery as you go in. There's a ceramic studio, and they have workshops and courses, but they also do this ceramic residency. And you do the residency and you get to explore clay, and at the end of it, you get an exhibition in the gallery upstairs. So, it's up to you how much I think you want clay to become a part of the exhibition. But for me, obviously, I just, somebody that works in materials and materials are so important, it was inevitable that I think I'd get lost completely in the medium of clay, and then it would mean that I have an exhibition that was very, very ceramic based.
And actually there's a really amazing show on right now till December with Phoebe Collings James, who's a friend of mine, and
right,
she spent 6 months like you did, and I think it's been fascinating to see the impact that residency's had on her work, because she's been doing a lot of like a group where you can go and do it, I think, in South London, to actually make ceramics and stuff as an ongoing part of her practice for a year or so. But I was just blown away by her current exhibition. It's really, I think Camden's so important, isn't it? Supporting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got an institutional show on the end of a residency. I mean, what an genius. Absolute dream.
Yeah.
It's amazing, no? And I think, they're so nurturing, and they really look after artists, I think. So I think, you always feel like artists are at the centre of the programme, which is really beautiful.
By the way, I was just looking up Mesopotamia, yeah. And it looks like it was the world's oldest recorded civilization. So it's like the kind of beginning of things. And it's actually where present-day Iraq is, and parts of Iran, Turkey, and Syria and Kuwait. So it's like, it's really interesting. That's like right the beginning of everything. Like human existence.
Humanship. There we go. So you were talking about the masks. Let's talk about his masks and the emojis. And you were like splicing the hieroglyphics and antique versions of the face, and then you're looking at the emoji now, and the emoji smiley, I guess, which is two eyes, a nose, a mouth. That's the fundamental recognition of the emoji smiley. But you're bringing that into these different versions of that within ceramics. And also your ceramics look like fabric. I want to talk about that as well, because a lot of these masks have a very fabric feel that obviously, you know, you're working within applique and, you know, not quilt making, but you're using fabric, felt making, for example. You said you're using yarn, and then the language of clay you're playing with alongside materials.
It's like folds, isn't it, in the ceramics?
Yeah. Pleating, yeah, like Issey Miyake.
Yeah.
So that ceramic mask series really came about by chance, and it came about whilst I was working on the Camden show. So obviously, instead of making, you know, a column segment, and then just putting any old glaze on it, or, you know, the ceramic masks were just were test pieces, really. So instead of just putting a plain tablet of clay with the glaze on it, or, you know, the little mark that I maybe wanted to use for the columns, I just started making faces in them. And it was a really sort of intuitive kind of to put my finger in it twice and make a mouth. And of course, you know, I mean, obviously this must have somehow connected with the fact that I'm looking at emojis and, you know, and also, you know, I'm kind of obsessed by masks anyway. So,
do you collect masks?
It was clay. So I think it was just, because I was so excited about having access to this kiln, I wanted to, every time the firing went on, I wanted to fill it up with something that I was going to use or maybe could use. So I couldn't even, you know, even when the ceramic technician was saying this is just a test, I felt like it had to be a test for something, you know. So I did that, and they started coming out from the kiln, and I'm kind of enjoying them. They're kind of the fun, you know. They just sort of had. But the thing that was amazing about them was that, you know, the variety of expressions and emotions that you would get with what is just a very simple action, you know. So I started to build on that with just different finishes, with the way, you know, they became real test plates. But with more and more, I started to be a little bit more to think about them a little bit more, and they became sort of less, you know, less intuitive in the fact that I was just, you know, doing something automatically. But yeah, I think it became a conscious decision not to repeat. That was the thing that I, you know, found once I'd done maybe 50 of them, that you become conscious of trying something new or bring. So, you know, you're thinking about it before, but up until that point, it was, you know, very free flowing.
Why are some called mask like mask and then others are called mask with an E at the end?
Because they're slightly different format. Because when I left the Camden Arts Centre, I no longer had access to the board that they were on. So, and then I moved and I finally got my own kiln, which was, you know, amazing.
Brilliant. I was going to ask that.
Oh my God, that's
amazing.
Like celebration.
It was life changing. It was like,
how much is a kiln? How much is it a kiln
not
to buy? How
thousands.
Do you?
I mean,
is it?
Yeah, I'd never ever had. I mean, it was about 4,000, I think. You know, all in with.
Do you have to plumb it in and get like permission from councils and stuff?
You do.
You do.
Yeah.
And you have to it's secure and safe, don't you? I know Lindsay Mendes
exactly.
had that.
And you have to have a proper electrician come and fix it in. And you know, the thing as an artist, it's really easy just to sort of, the money just disappears really quickly. So, you know, if you pretend that, you know, you're getting some money of something, it's you're never going to get it. Just channel it into that kiln, and that's what I did. And it's been a real game changer for me, because the freedom that allowed me then just to all of a sudden make ceramics directly from my studio was amazing.
It's good. That's actually really good advice, is as an artist, to invest back in yourself,
into your own art.
To constantly, you know, cycle it back into what you're doing. I always remember Lady Gaga talking about that very eloquently, about like her early touring and stuff, and how she was constantly broke because she had no money, because she was just pouring all the money back into her live concerts. And actually, as a kind of concept, that's a really good idea in contemporary art as well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Constantly. Sort of,
I think it's also for collectors listening, if they want to support young artists, emerging artists, is that actually you buy a work of art, but that funds the artist's production. That's going to buy your materials. That this sort of goes, it's a feeding system that goes back into the work to keep the work going.
Absolutely. I mean, because the other thing is there's so much work that never makes it to, you know, to a show. In a way, you know, you as an artist, like your outgoings are are so much higher, really, than just the production of the thing that you see. You know, it's the running costs are, you know, it ain't cheap.
Now, Jonathan, you and I are the same age, and I don't know if that's why, but I kept coming across your work, like literally every 3-4 months, I would come into contact with a show that you were involved with. And a lot of the shows I was seeing, this is back in like 2013 or something. Like, I remember you collaborated with a friend of mine, Julia, at Belmax Gallery in central London. This is, I think, pre-Stephen Friedman era for mm-hmm. you. So Julia Muggenberg, and you did an amazing show with Coco Crampton. And there were lots of eyes in that show, which I always remember, in like weird kind of sewn creatures that were like disembodied. And I remember coming to that show in Davis Street, which is right by that fancy hotel. It's not Claridge's, is it? What hotel is it?
Yeah, it's opposite Claridge's, oh, yeah.
It is Claridge's, yeah. And then, yeah. And then, like a few months later, you were in Charlotte Road, where our old Carl Friedman Gallery was, and directly opposite us, you did a show with L'Etrangère Gallery with the amazing Emma Hart, which was a brilliant show. And then, a few months later, it travelled. You and her went to Pier, just up the road, to Pier Gallery. So I kept, like, seeing your work. It was, like, all the time. And then previously, I'd seen you at Saatchi and da-da-da. But the thing that struck me about all of those times that I discovered you, it was collaborations with other artists. Can you speak a bit about the importance of, like, you know, coming up with your peers and that mutual support and even making work together?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if I think about collaboration, I think it's been one of the most important things, I think, for my sort of evolution as an artist, because I think quite often it's quite easy to get, as an artist, to get stuck in a sort of a certain trajectory, or not just by yourself, but sort of in the way that you might be expected to, you know, deliver a certain exhibition or... So when you work with another artist, you can sort of throw all of that to the side, because you don't have, you know, a back catalogue to work, you know, along. You can just do whatever the hell you both want to. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be really liberating. And I think it's really important to keep things fresh, isn't it, as an artist? Mm-hmm. I mean, to constantly, you know, test yourself. And I think working with, you know, an artist that you respect and you admire, I mean, what a better way of kind of
pushing, you know, yourself somewhere else.
Pushing yourself, exactly, than that. And you know, I've learned a lot from collaborating. So yeah, I would say definitely collaboration has been such an important part of my journey, and it's definitely something that I hope I continue to do, you know.
And with someone like Emma, like, can you speak a bit about that specific collaboration, just to give it a bit more?
Yeah, totally. So Emma and I met on a residency at Wising Arts Centre, which is, again, an amazing, amazing place for artists that, you know, and they do a lot for them. And
I love it. It's a beautiful place.
We didn't know each other before we did this residency, but for my part, Emma was an artist that I really admired and, you know, and I was really excited to meet. But it was just kind of one of these really exciting moments when you meet an artist that you really, really love, and then you find out that you get on with them really well. So we ended up becoming just really good friends, and then started seeing that there was so much in our practices that kind of overlapped, and, you know, that we were interested in. And so we just sort of sat down. I remember we were in the ceramic studio, because they've got this little ceramic studio in Wising Arts Centre. And we were, you know, I think Emma was preparing for her show at Camden Arts Centre at that time. And we were just having a conversation. We were like, wouldn't it be great to do a show together? And it was really just sort of an off-the-cuff remark like that we were like, wouldn't it be great to do a show together? And then a year later, we just started putting our heads together and thinking about how we could make it happen. And so it really is. And then from that, we did a show at L'Etrangère, which was a show called Suckers, which was a sort of a show about, I guess, about eating, about both of our kind of slight anxieties around going to dinner parties. But that led on to doing this collaborative show around Punch and Judy that started off at Pier Gallery and then went to the Grundy in Blackpool and ended up at the Delawarr Pavilion. And
Bexley-on-Sea, yeah, amazing.
In Bexley-on-Sea, and sort of got a bit bigger and bigger. But, you know, and that, you know, I have to also sort of flag up Ingrid at Pier as well for that, you know, for really pushing, making that happen. But I think what's exciting about that is that, you know, it's a story of, I guess, two artists that have just come together to collaborate on a show. And then it was us that made it, initiated, you know, doing a show together, a collaborative show together. So, you know, I think not only did I learn a lot from working with Emma, but I think it was, you know, it was a really great, just a great sort of example of, you know, what you can do if you sort of, if you push.
Connect.
Yeah, like self-empowerment. Yeah. It's quite an important message actually for artists to remember that you hold the power, you know, to what you want to achieve, even if you don't have all the resources right now. And it's kind of just about going for it, isn't it? And that's kind of what I think you've been a great example of. And in that L'Etrangère show, I never forget walking into it because it was right opposite our gallery. And I went in and it was just the most bizarre show because it had like knives and forks with fingernails on the ends of the knives and forks.
I've seen the pretzel like, fingernails like, with the acrylic like nails on. It's so camp and nails. Brilliant.
And like weird plates, and it was just like so strange. And I was like, what the fuck is this? But I didn't really, you know, it was just like I'd never seen it before. And that's also a great response, though, because I think, you know, new art, you want to kind of be shocked a bit and kind of it's something you haven't seen before.
I'm glad. I mean, I think, you know, that it felt exciting to make. And I think it was, and we had a lot of fun with it. And I think, you know, I think that's really important, you know, because that translates in the work. You know, if you're communicating that you're sort of letting go to a certain extent and just doing what feels right, you know. But it definitely was a show, a very sort of a campy horror show of different elements, you know, a dinner party gone very wrong.
And actually, there was something very unashamed about it, like you're saying. You know, when you were a kid and you were like shy about your collecting or your knitting or your whatever it is, it's like finally you get to a point where you're a bit like we have now, or I have anyway, where it's just like, I don't care.
Come out.
Take me as I am.
Come out.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, if you like me, you like me. If you don't, you don't. I love that about the work.
Absolutely. It's like something. I mean, I think even now I have to constantly remind myself of that, though. It's because it's such a precious feeling, isn't it, to have that and to be in that space, especially when you're aware of or you remember what it wasn't to have that. You know,
totally.
What is the upcoming Stockholm show going to be like? What are we going to see in that, and how's that going?
So it's all been packed and sent off now, and it's going to be 12 life-size human cocoons that will be hanging from the gallery ceiling. It's a sort of a subterranean gallery space that you walk down to get into. It's huge, I think after doing the Camden show, which is sort of things growing up from the floor, I'd had the idea that I wanted to make a show with things coming down from the ceiling. So these cocoons will dangle from the ceiling. They've been they're woven from a yarn that I had spun and dyed, and they sort of look to. I've been looking at chrysalises, but also birds' nests, like in particular the weaver bird nest. So they are again, I guess, one sort of beautiful, I hope, you know, in the way that they've been made, but also slightly disturbing, as in a lot of the work that I make.
Actually, weavers' birds' nests have really inspired a lot of architecture, haven't they? Like, kind of, because they have such a unique shape, don't they? They're these very strange forms. It kind of makes me think of Louise Bourgeois as well, and all of her hanging kind of bronze sculptures and the cocoons. But I feel like she might have thought about those birds, and you know what I mean? Like there's some, I don't know, that it's such a unique kind of form that...
They really are. They're kind of so incredible. And of course, they make them by essentially just knotting the grass with their beaks. So, you know, they're these... like vessel-like forms with little holes in them, it's the male bird that makes the nest, and then the female decides whether she'll pair up with him based on on how beautiful, how well
his craft skills,
his craftsmanship, exactly. So, but yeah, they're just totally amazing. It blows my mind. It's like nature just blowing my mind, you know. And and I think this sort of idea of these vessels being like spaces for transformation, you know, where you where in one sense, you know, for the chrysalises, it's becoming one form to another, but with the nests, it's becoming from egg to, you know, bird, which is, so they're these sort of magical incubators of life. And so I thought, you know, they're kind of rich pickings for, you know, an artwork there. And I've been obviously making the majority of them during lockdown and thinking about, you know, the significance of personal space and home and all of that. And spending so much time alone, you know, and so, you know, these pieces sort of came out of that, really. And but, you know, I've been making them in a very small studio and sort of making them and putting them to the side. So I'm really excited now to see what they will look like when they're installed, because that's the sort of moment where I get to see if it sort of works. But
what's it like when all your work leaves the studio? Is it quite is it excitement, or do you feel a sense of loss when they leave you?
Yeah, no, I love it. I really don't. I never understand this sort of feel. You know, when artists say, "Oh, I have that feeling of loss," or "I'm sad to see that," I'm like, on to the next. It's
all... You're love. Like, see ya.
You see you later. It's the process is so amazing and beautiful, and that's the moment I love the most. There's a fleeting moment where it's installed that I think this is amazing. But then I start getting really critical of it, and, you know, and then I start not liking it. So I'd rather just get on with the next thing. You know?
Where in Stockholm is the show going to be?
The show is at Accelerator in Stockholm, and it's a fairly new institution. So it's part of Stockholm University. It's been open about 3 years. And they've been... yeah, an absolute dream to work with. I have to say, I'm kind of, big shout out to them. So
amazing. Just something I've always loved about your work, Jonathan, when I've come to it, is this blur of gender. Yes, sometimes we see the figures might be pregnant, but it could be any gender that's carrying a baby potentially in its belly. Is that something that you like playing with, and is that important to you, that there is this kind of gender blur with your characters that you create?
Absolutely, yeah. I think more often than not, it's my body in the work, and so in my work, I don't need to adhere to any sort of the traditional binaries of, you know. So it's a sort of a liberation for me to be anything, can have any potential. Yeah, it's important. It's important.
Yeah. Totally. So the work is autobiographical or biographical. You're cherry picking from experiences and your own kind of interior for this work.
I think so. I think, you know, I think it's the one place that I have the freedom to speak from is from my own, you know, from my own vantage point, if you will. So yeah, the work is pretty autobiographical. And, you know, if I'm thinking about the body, this work, you know, the work that I make is a product of the body, and it's my body. So there is a sort of a very particular relationship that I have to the work, because it is in a way an extension of me, not just through the in its depictions, but actually in the essence of, you know, I was thinking about the cocoons and spinning my own yarn. It's this sort of, I had this sort of like the sort of action of every fiber going through my finger and thumb, you know, and that connection to the work that I have is so specific, I guess. You know, it's kind of like, you know, a spider spinning a web, or, you know, it really is a product of me. And so even, you know, maybe the sort of the cast body parts, which are mine, my body parts, obviously, in the work, you know, they are, it's all a sort of a shedding of skin of me, or, you know, or, yeah, an extension, an extension of my body.
I like that idea of shedding. Like, it's a bit, it's almost like a snake when it sheds its skin or something. But when you were talking earlier and you kind of weren't totally sure what you were describing, to me it was like this idea that our bodies are actually just the bodies, but within us we have the soul, or you have your personality and all of these things that like are so much more than just the body. And I think if you think about, I don't know, disability, or you think about, you know, even like my mum, for example, has just had like a hip operation, and like this idea that you kind of, I don't know, that our bodies can somehow limit us, but ideas or the soul can actually soar, and they can be, you know, so much more than just that.
The flesh,
yeah. Absolutely. And I think that definitely is present within your work. I think even going back to that show years ago in Davis Street, like, I don't know, this idea of like the disembodied parts or the eyeball, or like, I don't know, like all of these elements, which are, yeah, it's fascinating.
I think this is why, you know, I really, you know, costume features a lot, you know, the sort of performance, and then, you know, the costumes that I make are usually cover almost every part of the human body. So it really is sort of entering into another being, and so to sort of cover up the body underneath, you know, somehow can be sort of quite liberating, because you are able to become something else which isn't so rooted in, you know, in the ways in which we usually go about sort of identifying each other on, you know, and projecting on each other, you know, which is, you know, I hate boxes, you know, but I think it's such a sort of human instinct to sort of put each other in boxes and to limit each other in a way because of that. So, you know, there's this sort of absolute freedom in becoming something other, you know.
It's the same with language, isn't it? It's like people can name something, you can expect it, and then that's kind of concretely what somebody is, but actually we're not that. And I think it's like what we said about that Oscar Wilde quote, you know, it's a very well-known quote, but it's actually so accurate, this idea that, you know, you can be something else all the time, and we can constantly evolve and be much more than what is expected, right? Or people,
what the limitations of what is being projected onto you. Yeah.
Can I ask you something quite personal? I don't know whether you go here, but like, we interviewed Rachel Feinstein recently, and we spoke a bit about what it's like to be part of an artist couple, because she's married to John Curran. And actually, Rachel Feinstein's sculptures, I think you would love, because she also looks at that history of the actual colour of the sculptures and how kind of mental the actual sculptures were.
She used to give people she was dating earrings that were casts of her bumhole. Yeah. As like an offering.
Yeah. You wouldn't.
And to friends. Know? It wasn't just people she was dating. Yeah. But you're part of an artist couple, like with Rafael Zajko, who I know because he invited me to teach, actually, to be a crit, whatever you call it, at Goldsmiths. Can you speak a bit about the relationship of going out with someone who's an artist and the influence you have on each other's work?
Yeah, of course. I think, okay, so from my experience, I would say it's really positive. It's really great. I think we have, and I really mean this, because it does. I'm not just saying this because it's been corny, but it for me, it's a really positive thing to have an artist partner, because they, you know, they. I think what's fundamental is that you respect their work and you love it. If I didn't, I think that would be a little bit of a, but we're not sort of, there's not any of this sort of unhealthy competition between us, and we're very supportive of each other's work. I mean, actually, Raf collaborated with me in the show that I just had in Madrid at La Casa Encendida, and he performed with me in costume and sang a Polish funerary song at the end of the performance, and I actually also incorporated some of his he has his smoking sculptures that he did recently in a show, and I brought some of that. I cheekily pinched that idea and incorporated it into my costumes, and then they started blowing out smoke. So he's obviously okay with me, you know, using that in my work. And, you know, I always credit him for anything we do together. And I think crediting artists is obviously that you work with is important. But yeah, for me, it's really he's the person that I go to, you know, he's like my sounding board. If I have, you know, ideas, I think we're very honest with each other. So, you know, he'll give me his opinion if he thinks something's really rubbish. And so I really cherish that sort of, you know, the frustrating thing sometimes, or the bad bit of going out with another artist, is that you can never really schedule things, or you can guarantee that while one has a show to work on, yeah, the other one doesn't. And that is really annoying, because sometimes you have a show and you're like, oh, should we just have a few days off afterwards? And it's like, you can bet your bottom dollar that it'll be when he's really busy with something too. So I don't know. There are definitely, that's the negatives, I would say. But
I was blown away when I first met him, because he just completed that series of where he kind of blows, you know, human carbon dioxide or whatever it is you expel from your body, but he would blow into the sculpture. And I remember just being like, as a concept, it was so hardcore, because it's like, you know, this idea that the sculpture is completed when the artist has the artist's breath is within it.
Life into it.
You know, and it was so full on. And I was really, I don't know, I think it's quite a remarkable body of work that he's creating. I'd love to talk to him actually at some point. But I also just love your connection. I saw you both at Lindsay Mendick and Guy Oliver's space, Quench, here in Margate. And just your connection with each other and your enthusiasm and the joy you both have at looking at other people's art. And like, I don't know, I just felt like there's a real camaraderie that must be a great sort of comfort as an artist.
Oh yeah, no, it is. And you know, and he's bonkers too, so you know, that's always, you know, it's like if you meet someone that's like as mad as you are, then it's like, you know, that it's you've got a good team. So
push each other's further. You go crazy.
Exactly.
You go crazier.
Exactly, you know. So yeah, no, it's brilliant.
Oh, well, before we get on to our final questions, I just want to know, how long does it take to spin the yarn for a life-size cocoon, let alone 12?
So it takes to spin two skeins. I never know how to say it. It's just this sort of the name that you call, like a ball of wool, but sort of a loose ball of wool. Mm-hmm. It takes about a day, which is a really long time to take it from like sheep's wool. And the reason why I just want to say, the reason why it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just a sadist. The reason why I wanted to spin my own yarn is because I wanted it to be lumpy and irregular. I wanted it to have that bodiliness of it looking a bit like, I don't know, like an umbilical cord or, you know, arteries or something. And of course, you can't get that when you buy machine-made wool. So, yeah, I decided crazily that to spin it by myself would be the way forward, but basically meant I haven't had a weekend off for the whole of the summer.
Yes. Well, you are elevating traditional domestic craft into something incredibly beautiful and powerful.
No. Oh, well.
So we ask every guest two questions, which hopefully you will know. But the first one is, if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork from around the world or any building or anything, what would you steal?
So, you know what? I'm going to say, I don't know whether this has already been said, but is it like Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights? I saw that at the Prado recently. And it was just, I mean, I know this is a classic and it's, you know, but it's
such a good one. It's iconic.
It's amazing. And you know, and the thing about seeing it in life is that it's not just the front, is it? It's also got the back, you know, so because it's this, but that is, I think that's, I mean, it's just, you could just look at it for hours. I mean, I imagine that.
It's like three panels, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's, and it's just something these two doors that sort of open.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think because of obviously COVID, the last time I visited, it was quite quiet. And so usually there's like a lot of people around it, but this time it was, I had a sort of an experience of what it would be like to view it on an almost one-to-one.
Amazing. And the thing is, that work is so hardcore, and also it's got that element of humour to it, because I think at the time it would have been quite shocking, but there's a definite an element of humour, which I think sometimes, you know, gets referenced with your work. And there's that Somerset House show coming up that Andy Holden's curating, which is all about humour, and Ryan Gander did one a few years ago at South London Gallery. But like, what is your relationship to humour within your work? Because I think it's quite an awkward one in art sometimes, like, you know, everything's quite wordy and serious.
It's humour / camp / sinister. There's like a fine light line between all of it.
That is Jonathan Baldock.
Yes.
I'll take that. I think there's certain... I love a bit of humour, you know? I think humour is massively undervalued in society, actually. Because I think, you know, think about comics, really, you know, they're amazing, you know? I mean, to be able to take you out of yourself and just feel relief to that level where you're laughing is, I mean, that's real power, I think. And I think there's some sort of, there's definitely sort of hierarchies, aren't there? You know, the more sort of serious emotions are sometimes valued more, but I think humor's powerful. I don't think I've ever employed it to that level at all, by the way, but I'd be lucky if I get a small chuckle, but there's definitely humor is something that I enjoy, you know. And I think it's a very sort of theatrical trope as well, isn't
exactly
it?
comedy tragedy
exactly, sort of flip that switch and then all of a sudden have you sobbing, you know.
It's the best. For me, as an actor as well, that's the best comedy, is when you can make someone laugh and then you can spin suddenly a second later and they're crying. And I think that was why Robin Williams, for me, was one of my biggest heroes, because he had that ability to just flip that in like a millisecond.
I agree.
Yeah. So the other question we ask is, what is your favourite colour?
And this is a difficult one because my favourite colour changes all the time, which you'll probably see. I mean, I love colour. Someone called me a colorista recently, which I was
colorista. I'm going to write that down.
Like a barista, but for color.
That's
colorista.
Me. I would say at the minute that, I mean, I'm going to go for pink. It's always a favorite.
I was going to say pink makes sense when I think about you, because I think pink appears a lot in your work, actually.
It's my rosy cheeks.
Yes, and sometimes when the acrylic nails you have, your stick-on nails you have, always bright pink or bright red.
Bright pink, exactly.
Talking about baristas, I got given a latte today that, you know, they do that art within the latte, and sometimes it's like her thing.
On the
I
phone.
I got given this thing, and she handed it to me really proudly and said, I did a rose for you, you know, as the a kind of the art within the latte. And it just looked like a penis. I was like, this isn't a rose.
But you put it straight in your mouth, didn't you?
Russell,
it was
like, are they trying to say something to me?
Yes, they are. And not metaphorically. They're being.
Oh my god, I'm shocked.
It was a shot of coffee.
Exactly. What advice would you give then to a young artist now, if you were to meet them and they were like, "I'm really worried about everything"?
Just to keep going is actually one of one of the hardest things to do as an artist. So I guess my advice would come from my personal experience. I think, so it would be probably to dance the beat of your own drum would be a good one. So don't follow fashions or trends, because they come and go. But I think if you stay true and authentic to your work, then, you know, you're on the right path. I'd say be kind is a good one as well. I mean, don't be a bit of a big head or, I think that always, that's a good one to know. Collaboration, as we've already talked about, I think that's a really good, I learned a lot about myself as an artist, I think, through collaboration. And I think it just opens you up to just other people's perspectives and gives you a chance to experiment. And I think that's really, really valuable. Another thing that I would say would be just to improvise. So for me, I came to working in salt dough because I couldn't afford to work in clay, or I used textiles because I was a bit intimidated by the sculpture department at college, or, you know, any number of ways in which I think you could approach making work in a sort of a very set and sort of formal, but just to open your heart to maybe other possibilities, and I could be really valuable actually. And it's that just do it, you know, thing. I've always been, you know, I think you can really, I think overthinking things and just not actually doing it can be a big problem, because you just never will. And so just sort of jump in and do it to the best that you can. And that will always lead on to a different.
Exactly.
That's what Warhol said. He said, just make the work. And while people are working out if they like it or not, you're on to the next thing.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. And you find like-minded souls, don't you? Like-minded friends or artists or fans or what have you.
You do. And you learn. Yeah, you know, it's all, you're always learning from making, I think. And that sometimes gets forgotten, you know. It's
keep going, keep making, keep learning.
Keep going.
Great advice. Yeah. Jonathan, you have been the absolute dream. We adore you. I adore you. We need to go antiquing together. And we all need to drink penis coffee with Rob at some point soon, which would be the dream. And for everyone listening, go to @talkart on Instagram, and we will be posting images of this interview today. Jonathan, you're on Instagram, right?
Yes, I am.
What's your handle?
Oh, I think it's just Jonathan underscore Baldock.
Perfect.
And you can also visit Stephen Friedman Gallery, who have lots of amazing archive images on their website. I love their website.
Camden Arts Centre, please follow them. They're an incredible institution that is...
And where's the show in Stockholm again?
Accelerator.
When does that open?
It opens on the 14th of October. Get it right. There you go. October.
And the weaver bird, is that a British bird that you can find in your Reader's Digest book of birds?
It's not, I'm afraid. No, it's not a local. You won't get it out in the garden, I'm afraid. But
cross that one off.
Google it. You will. You'll be amazed. There'll be enough videos on YouTube of it, if not.
Amazing. Amazing stuff.
Well, thank you, Jonathan.
We'll stick around, Jonathan. Thanks for listening. Everyone listening, thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Cheers, Jonathan.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.